He drove on. The sky was impossibly blue, and white industrial smoke rising from factory chimneys was frozen in the sky like a photograph. A hawk launched itself from a dead tree and flew toward him, wings strobing in the sunlight like a series of stop-motion photographs. At some point he found himself heading into East St. Louis. He attempted to avoid it, and instead found himself driving through what appeared to be a red-light district in an industrial park. 18-wheelers and huge rigs were parked outside buildings that looked like temporary warehouses that claimed to be 24-hour nightclubs and, in one case, the best peep show in town. Shadow shook his head and drove on. Laura had loved to dance, clothed or naked, and, on several memorable evenings, moving from one state to the other. And he had loved to watch her. Lunch was a sandwich and a can of Coke in a town called Red Bud. He passed a valley filled with the wreckage of thousands of yellow bulldozers, tractors, and caterpillars. He wondered if this was the bulldozers' graveyard where the bulldozers went to die. He drove past the Papa Top Lounge. He drove through Chester, home of Popeye. He noticed that the houses had started to gain pillars out front, that even the shabbiest, thinnest house now had its white pillars, proclaiming it, in someone's eyes, a mansion. He drove over a big, muddy river and laughed out loud when he saw that the name of it, according to the sign, was the Big Muddy River. He saw a covering of brown kudzu over three winter-dead trees, twisting them into strange, almost human shapes. They could have been witches, three bent old crones ready to reveal his fortune. He drove alongside the Mississippi. Shadow had never seen the Nile, but there was a blinding afternoon sun burning on the wide brown river, which made him think of the muddy expanse of the Nile, not the Nile as it is now, but as it was long ago, flowing like an artery through the papyrus marshes, home to cobra and jackal and wild cow. A road sign pointed to Thebes. The road was built up about 12 feet, so he was driving above the marshes. Clumps and clusters of birds in flight were questing back and forth, black dots against the blue sky, moving in some desperate Brownian motion. In the late afternoon the sun began to lower, gilding the world in elf light, a thick, warm, custardy light that made the world feel unearthly and more than real. And it was in this light that Shadow passed the sign telling him he was now entering historical Cairo. He drove under a bridge and found himself in a small port town. The imposing structure of the Cairo courthouse and even the more imposing customs house looked like enormous, freshly baked cookies in the syrupy gold of the light at the end of the day. He parked his car in a side street and walked to the embankment at the edge of a river, unsure whether he was gazing at the Ohio or the Mississippi. A small brown cat nosed and sprang among the trash cans at the back of a building, and the light made even the garbage magical. A lone seagull was gliding along the river's edge, flipping a wing to correct itself as it went. Shadow realized that he wasn't alone. A small girl wearing old tennis shoes on her feet and a man's gray woolen sweater as a dress was standing on the sidewalk 10 feet away from him, staring at him with the somber gravity of a 6-year-old. Her hair was black and straight and long. Her skin was as brown as the river. He grinned at her. She stared back at him defiantly. There was a squeal and a yowl from the waterfront, and the little brown cat shot away from a spilled garbage can, pursued by a long-muzzled black dog. The cat scurried under a car. "Hey," said Shadow to the girl, "you ever seen invisible powder before?" She hesitated. Then she shook her head. "Okay," said Shadow. "Well, watch this." Shadow pulled out a quarter with his left hand, held it up, tilting it from one side to another, then appeared to toss it into his right hand, closing his hand hard on nothing, and putting the hand forward. "Now," he said, "I'll just take some invisible powder from my pocket." And he reached his left hand into his breast pocket, dropping the quarter into the pocket as he did so. "And I sprinkle it on the hand with the coin," and he mimed sprinkling. "And look, now the quarter's invisible, too." He opened his empty right hand, and, in astonishment, his empty left hand as well. The little girl just stared. Shadow shrugged, and put his hands back in his pockets, loading a quarter in one hand, a folded-up $5 bill in the other. He was going to produce them from the air and then give the girl the $5. She looked like she needed it. "Hey," he said, "we've got an audience." The black dog and the little brown cat were watching him as well, flanking the girl, looking up at him intently. The dog's huge ears were pricked up, giving it a comically alert expression. A crane-like man with gold-rimmed spectacles was coming up the sidewalk toward them, peering from side to side as if he were looking for something. Shadow wondered if he was the dog's owner. "What did you think?" Shadow asked the dog, trying to put the little girl at her ease. "Was that cool?" The black dog licked its long snout. Then it said, in a deep, dry voice, "I saw Harry Houdini once, and believe me, man, you are no Harry Houdini." The little girl looked at the animals. She looked up at Shadow, and then she ran off, her feet pounding the sidewalk as if all the powers of hell were after her. The two animals watched her go. The crane-like man had reached the dog. He reached down and scratched its high, pointed ears. "Come on," said the man in the gold-rimmed spectacles to the dog. "It was only a coin trick. It's not like he was doing an underwater escape." "Not yet," said the dog, "but he will." The golden light was done, and the gray of twilight had begun. Shadow dropped the coin and the folded bill back into his pocket. "Okay," he said, "which one of you is Jackal?"
"Use your eyes,"
said the black dog with the long snout. It began to amble along the sidewalk beside the man in the gold glasses, and after a moment's hesitation, Shadow followed them. The cat was nowhere to be seen. They reached a large old building on a row of boarded-up houses. The sign beside the door said, "Ibis and Jaquel, a family firm, funeral parlor, since 1863. "I'm Mr. Ibis," said the man in the gold-rimmed glasses. "I think I should buy you a spot of supper. I'm afraid my friend here has some work that needs doing." Somewhere in America. New York scares Salim, and so he clutches his sample case protectively with both hands, holding it to his chest. He is scared of black people, the way they stare at him. And he is scared of the Jews, the ones dressed all in black with hats and beards and side curls he can identify, and how many others that he cannot. He is scared of the sheer quantity of the people, all shapes and sizes of people, as they spill from their high, high, filthy buildings onto the sidewalks. He is scared of the honking hullabaloo of the traffic, and he is even scared of the air, which smells both dirty and sweet, and nothing at all like the air of Oman. Salim has been in New York, in America, for a week. Each day he visits two, perhaps three, different offices, opens his sample case, shows them the copper trinkets, the rings and bottles and tiny flashlights, the models of the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, the Eiffel Tower, gleaming in copper inside. Each night he writes a fax to his brother-in-law, Fuad, at home in Muscat, telling him that he has taken no orders, or, on one happy day, that he had taken several orders. But as Salim is painfully aware, not yet enough even to cover his airfare and hotel bill. For reasons Salim does not understand, his brother-in-law's business partners have booked him into the Paramount Hotel on 46th Street. He finds it confusing, claustrophobic, expensive, alien. Fouad is Salim's sister's husband. He's not a rich man, but he is the co-owner of a small trinket factory. Everything is made for export, to other Arab countries, to Europe, to America. Salim has been working for Fouad for 6 months. Fouad scares him a little. The tone of Fouad's faxes is becoming harsher. In the evening, Salim sits in his hotel room, reading his Quran, telling himself that this will pass, that his stay in this strange world is limited and finite. His brother-in-law gave him $1,000 for miscellaneous traveling expenses, and the money, which seemed so huge a sum when first he saw it, is evaporating faster than Salim can believe. When he first arrived, scared of being seen as a cheap Arab, he tipped everyone, handing extra dollar bills to everyone he encountered. And then he decided that he was being taken advantage of, that perhaps they were even laughing at him. And he stopped tipping entirely. On his first and only journey by subway, he got lost and confused, and missed his appointment. Now he takes taxis only when he has to, and the rest of the time he walks. He stumbles into overheated offices, his cheeks numb from the cold outside, sweating beneath his coat, shoes soaked by slush. And when the winds blow down the avenues, which run from north to south, as the streets run west to east, all so simple, and Salim always knows where to face Mecca, he feels a cold on his exposed skin that is so intense, it is like being struck. He never eats at the hotel, for while the hotel bill is being covered by Fouad's business partners, he must pay for his own food. Instead, he buys food at falafel houses and at little food stores, smuggles it up to the hotel beneath his coat for days before he realizes that no one cares. And even then he feels strange about carrying the bags of food into the dimly lit elevators. Salim always has to bend and squint to find the button to press to take him to his floor, and up to the tiny white room in which he stays. Salim is upset. The fax that was waiting for him when he woke this morning was curt, and alternately chiding, stern, and disappointed. Salim was letting them down. His sister, Fouad, Fouad's business partners, the Sultanate of Oman, the whole Arab world. Unless he was able to get the orders, Fouad would no longer consider it his obligation to employ Salim. They depended upon him. His hotel was too expensive. What was Salim doing with their money, living like a sultan in America? Salim read the fax in his room, which has always been too hot and stifling, so last night he opened a window and was now too cold. And sat there for a time, his face frozen into an expression of complete misery. Then Salim walks downtown, holding his sample case as if it contained diamonds and rubies, trudging through the cold for block after block until, on Broadway and 19th Street, he finds a squat building over a deli. He walks up the stairs to the fourth floor, to the office of Pan Global Imports. The office is dingy, but he knows that Pan Global handles almost half of the ornamental souvenirs that enter the U.S. from the Far East. A real order, a significant order from Pan Global, could redeem Salim's journey, could make the difference between failure and success. So Salim sits on an uncomfortable wooden chair in an outer office, his sample case balanced on his lap, staring at the middle-aged woman with her hair dyed too bright a red, who sits behind the desk, blowing her nose on Kleenex after Kleenex. After she blows her nose, she wipes it and drops the Kleenex into the trash. Salim got there at 10:30 a.m., half an hour before his appointment. Now he sits there, flushed and shivering, wondering if he is running a fever. The time ticks by so slowly. Salim looks at his watch, then he clears his throat. The woman behind the desk glares at him. "Yes," she says. It sounds like, "Yed?" "It is 11:35," says Salim. The woman glances at the clock on the wall and says, "Yed," again.
He did.
My appointment was for 11, says Salim with a placating smile. Mr. Blanding knows you're here, she tells him, reprovingly.
Mr. Blanding knows you're here.
Salim picks up an old copy of the New York Post from the table. He speaks English better than he reads it, and he puzzles his way through the stories like a man doing a crossword puzzle. He waits. A plump young man with the eyes of a hurt puppy, glancing from his watch to his newspaper to the clock on the wall. At 12:30, several men come out from the inner office. They talk loudly, jabbering away to each other in American. One of them, a big, paunchy man, has a cigar unlit in his mouth. He glances at Salim as he comes out. He tells the woman behind the desk to try the juice of a lemon and zinc, as his sister swears by zinc and vitamin C. She promises him that she will and gives him several envelopes. He pockets them, and then he and the other men go out into the hall. The sound of their laughter disappears down the stairwell. It's 1 o'clock. The woman behind the desk opens a drawer and takes out a brown paper bag, from which she removes several sandwiches, an apple, and a Milky Way. She also takes out a small plastic bottle of freshly squeezed orange juice.
"Excuse me," says Salim, "but can you perhaps call Mr. Blanding and tell him that I am still waiting?"
She looks up at him as if surprised to see that he is still there, as if they have not been sitting 5 feet apart for 2.5 hours.
"He's at lunch," she says. "He did lunch."
Salim knows, deep down in his gut, that Blanding was the man with the unlit cigar.
"When will he be back?"
She shrugs, takes a bite of her sandwich.
"He's busy with appointments for the rest of the day," she says.
"He's busy with appointments for the rest of the day." "Will he see me, then, when he comes back?" asks Salim.
She shrugs and blows her nose. Salim is hungry, increasingly so, and frustrated and powerless. At 3 o'clock, the woman looks at him and says,
"He won't be coming back."
"Excuse?"
"Mr. Blanding, he won't be coming back today."
"Can I make an appointment for tomorrow?"
She wipes her nose.
"You have to telephone. Appointments only by telephone."
"I see," says Salim.
And then he smiles. A salesman, Fuad had told him many times before he left Muscat, is naked in America without his smile.
"Tomorrow I will telephone," he says.
He takes his sample case and he walks down the many stairs to the street, where the freezing rain is turning to sleet. Salim contemplates the long, cold walk back to the 46th Street Hotel and the weight of the sample case. Then he steps to the edge of the sidewalk and waves at every yellow cab that approaches, whether the light on top is on or off, and every cab drives past him. One of them accelerates as it passes. A wheel dives into a water-filled pothole, spraying freezing muddy water over Salim's pants and coat. For a moment he contemplates throwing himself in front of one of the lumbering cars, and then he realizes that his brother-in-law would be more concerned with the fate of the sample case than of Salim himself, and that he would bring grief to no one but his beloved sister, Fuad's wife, for he had always been a slight embarrassment to his father and mother, and his romantic encounters had always, of necessity, been both brief and relatively anonymous. Also, he doubts that any of the cars is going fast enough, actually, to end his life. A battered yellow taxi draws up beside him, and, grateful to be able to abandon his train of thought, Salim gets in. The back seat is patched with gray duct tape. The half-open plexiglass barrier is covered with notices warning him not to smoke, telling him how much to pay to get to the various airports. The recorded voice of somebody famous he has never heard of tells him to remember to wear his seatbelt.
"The Paramount Hotel, please," says Salim.
The cab driver grunts and pulls away from the curb into the traffic. He is unshaven, and he wears a thick, dust-colored sweater and black plastic sunglasses. The weather is gray, and night is falling. Salim wonders if the man has a problem with his eyes. The wipers smear the street scene into grays and smudged lights. From nowhere, a truck pulls out in front of them,
and the cab driver swears by the beard of the prophet. Salim stares at the name on the dashboard, but he cannot make it out from here.
"How long have you been driving a cab, my friend?" he asks the man in his own language.
10 years, says the driver in the same tongue. "Where are you from?"
"Muscat," says Salim.
"In Oman." "From Oman? I have been in Oman. It was a long time ago. Have you heard of the city of Ubar?"
asks the taxi driver.
"Indeed I have," says Salim. "The lost city of towers. They found it in the desert 5-10 years ago. I do not remember exactly." "Were you with the expedition that excavated it?"
"Something like that. It was a good city," says the taxi driver. "On most nights there would be 3, maybe 4,000 people camped there. Every traveler would rest at Ubar, and the music would play, and the wine would flow like water, and the water would flow as well, which was why the city existed."
"That is what I have heard," says Salim. "And it perished, what, 1,000 years ago? 2,000?
The taxi driver says nothing. They are stopped at a red traffic light. The light turns green, but the driver does not move, despite the immediate discordant blare of horns behind them. Hesitantly, Salim reaches through the hole in the plexiglass, and he touches the driver on the shoulder. The man's head jerks up with a start, and he puts his foot down on the gas, lurching them across the intersection.
"Fuck shit, fuck fuck,"
he says in English. "You must be very tired, my friend," says Salim.
"I have been driving this Allah-forgotten taxi for 30 hours, says the driver. "It is too much. Before that I sleep for 5 hours, and I drove 14 hours before that. We are short-handed before Christmas."
"I hope you have made a lot of money," says Salim. The driver sighs.
"Not much. This morning I drove a man from 51st Street to Newark Airport. When we got there, he ran off into the airport, and I could not find him again. A $50 fare gone, and I had to pay the tolls on the way back myself."
Salim nods. "I had to spend today waiting to see a man who will not see me. My brother-in-law hates me. I have been in America for a week, and it has done nothing but eat my money. I sell nothing."
"What do you sell?"
"Shit," says Salim. "Worthless googles and baubles and tourist trinkets. Horrible, cheap, foolish, ugly shit."
The taxi driver wrenches the wheel to the right, swings around something, drives on. Salim wonders how he can see to drive between the rain, the night, and the thick sunglasses.
"You try to sell shit?"
"Yes," says Salim, thrilled and horrified that he has spoken the truth about his brother-in-law's samples.
"And they will not buy it?"
"No."
"Strange. You look at the stores here, that is all they sell."
Salim smiles nervously. A truck is blocking the street in front of them. A red-faced cop standing in front of it waves and shouts and points them down the nearest street.
"We will go over to 8th Avenue, come uptown that way," says the taxi driver.
They turn onto the street where the traffic has stopped completely. There is a cacophony of horns, but the cars do not move. The driver sways in his seat. His chin begins to descend to his chest 1, 2, 3 times. Then he begins, gently, to snore. Salim reaches out to wake the man, hoping that he's doing the right thing. As he shakes his shoulder, the driver moves, and Salim's hand brushes the man's face, knocking the sunglasses from his face into his lap. The taxi driver opens his eyes and reaches for and replaces the black plastic sunglasses, but it is too late. Salim has seen his eyes. The car crawls forward in the rain. The numbers on the meter increase.
"Are you going to kill me?" asks Salim.
The taxi driver's lips are pressed together. Salim watches his face in the driver's mirror.
"No,"
says the driver very quietly. The car stops again. The rain patters on the roof. Salim begins to speak.
"My grandmother swore that she had seen an ifrit, or perhaps a marid, late one evening on the edge of the desert. We told her that it was just a sandstorm, a little wind, but she said no. She saw its face, and its eyes, like yours, were burning flames.
The driver smiles, but his eyes are hidden behind the black plastic glasses, and Salim cannot tell whether there is any humor in that smile or not.
"The grandmothers came here, too," he says.
"Are there many jinn in New York?" asks Salim.
"No, not many of us."
"There are the angels, and there are men who Allah made from mud, and then there are the people of the fire, the jinn," says Salim.
"People know nothing about my people here," says the driver. "They think we grant wishes. If I could grant wishes, do you think I would be driving a cab?"
"I do not understand."
The taxi driver seems gloomy. Salim stares at his face in the mirror as he speaks, watching the ifrit's dark lips.
"They believe that we grant wishes. Why do they believe that? I sleep in one stinking room in Brooklyn. I drive this taxi for any stinking freak who has the money to ride in it, and for some who don't. I drive them where they need to go, and sometimes they tip me. Sometimes they pay me."
His lower lip began to tremble. The ifrit seemed on edge.
"One of them shat on the back seat once. I had to clean it before I could take the cab back. How could he do that? I had to clean the wet shit from the seat. Is that right?"
Salim puts out a hand, pats the ifrit's shoulder. He can feel solid flesh through the wool of the sweater. The ifrit raises his hand from the wheel, rests it on Salim's hand for a moment. Salim thinks of the desert, then red sands blow a dust storm through his thoughts, and the scarlet silks of the tents that surrounded the lost city of Ubar flap and billow through his mind. They drive up 8th Avenue.
"The old believe. They do not piss into holes, because the prophet told them that jinn live in holes. They know that the angels throw flaming stars at us when we try to listen to their conversations. But even for the old, when they come to this country, we are very, very far away. Back there, I did not have to drive a cab."
"I am sorry," says Salim.
"It is a bad time," says the driver. "A storm is coming. It scares me. I would do anything to get away."
The two of them say nothing more on their way back to the hotel. When Salim gets out of the cab, he gives the ifrit a $20 bill, tells him to keep the change. Then, with a sudden burst of courage, he tells him his room number. The taxi driver says nothing in reply. A young woman clambers into the back of the cab, and it pulls out into the cold and the rain. 6 o'clock in the evening. Salim has not yet written the facts to his brother-in-law. He goes out into the rain, buys himself this night's kebab and French fries. It has only been a week, but he feels that he is becoming heavier, rounder, softening in this country of New York. When he comes back to the hotel, he is surprised to see the taxi driver standing in the lobby, hands deep into his pockets. He is staring at a display of black and white postcards. When he sees Salim, he smiles, self-consciously.
"I called your room," he says, "but there was no answer, so I thought I would wait."
Salim smiles also and touches the man's arm.
"I am here," he says.
Together they enter the dim, green-lit elevator, ascend to the 5th floor holding hands. The ifrit asks if he may use Salim's bathroom.
"I feel very dirty," he says.
Salim nods. He sits on the bed, which fills most of the small white room, and listens to the sound of the shower running. Salim takes off his shoes, his socks, and then the rest of his clothes. The taxi driver comes out of the shower, wet, with a towel wrapped about his midsection. He is not wearing his sunglasses. And in the dim room, his eyes burn with scarlet flames. Salim blinks back tears.
"I wish you could see what I see," he says.
"I do not grant wishes,"
whispers the ifrit, dropping his towel
and pushing Salim gently but irresistibly down onto the bed. It is an hour or more before the ifrit comes, thrusting and grinding into Salim's mouth. Salim has already come twice in this time. The jinn's semen tastes strange, fiery, and it burns Salim's throat. Salim goes to the bathroom, washes out his mouth. When he returns to the bedroom, the taxi driver is already asleep in the white bed, snoring peacefully. Salim climbs into the bed beside him, cuddles close to the ifrit, imagining the desert on his skin. As he starts to fall asleep, he realizes that he still has not written his fax to Fuad, and he feels guilty. Deep inside, he feels empty and alone. He reaches out, rests his hand on the ifrit's tumescent cock, and, comforted, he sleeps. They wake in the small hours, moving against each other, and they make love again. At one point, Salim realizes that he is crying, and the ifrit is kissing away his tears with burning lips.
"What is your name?"
Salim asks the taxi driver.
"There is a name on my driving permit, but it is not mine,"
the ifrit says. Afterward, Salim could not remember where the sex had stopped and the dreams began. When Salim wakes, the cold sun creeping into the white room, he is alone. Also, he discovers his sample case is gone. All the bottles and rings and souvenir copper flashlights, all gone, along with his suitcase, his wallet, his passport, and his air tickets back to Oman. He finds a pair of jeans, the T-shirt and the dust-colored woolen sweater discarded on the floor. Beneath them he finds a driver's license in the name of Ibrahim bin Irem, a taxi permit in the same name, and a ring of keys with an address written on a piece of paper attached to them in English. The photographs on the license and the permit did not look much like Salim, but then they did not look much like the ifrit. The telephone rings. It is the front desk calling to point out that Salim has already checked out and his guest needs to leave soon so that they can service the room to get it ready for another occupant.
"I do not grant wishes," says Salim,
tasting the way the words shape themselves in his mouth. He feels strangely light-headed as he dresses. New York is very simple. The avenues run north to south. The streets run west to east. How hard can it be? He asks himself. He tosses the car keys into the air and catches them. Then he puts on the black plastic sunglasses he found in the pockets and leaves the hotel room to go and look for his cab.
This ends Disc 6. American Gods, Disc 7.
Chapter 8. He said the dead had souls, but when I asked him how that could be, I thought the dead were souls, he broke my trance. Don't that make you suspicious that there's something the dead are keeping back? Yes, there's something the dead are keeping back. Robert Frost, Two Witches. The week before Christmas is often a quiet one in a funeral parlor, Shadow learned, over supper. They were sitting in a small restaurant, two blocks from Ibis and Jacquel's funeral parlor. Shadow's meal consisted of an all-day full breakfast. It came with hush puppies, while Mr. Ibis picked and pecked at a slice of coffee cake. Mr. Ibis explained it to him. "The lingering ones are holding on for one final Christmas," said Mr. Ibis, "or even for New Year's, while the others, the ones for whom other people's jollity and celebration will prove too painful, have not yet been tipped over the edge by that last showing of It's a Wonderful Life. have not quite encountered the final straw, or should I say the final sprig of holly that breaks not the camel's but the reindeer's back. And he made a little noise as he said it, half smirk, half snort, which suggested that he had just uttered a well-honed phrase of which he was particularly fond. Ibis and Jacquel was a small family-owned funeral home, one of the last truly independent funeral homes in the area, or so Mr. Ibis maintained. Most fields of human merchandising value nationwide brand identities, he said. Mr. Ibis spoke in explanations, a gentle, earnest lecturing that put Shadow in mind of a college professor who used to work out at the Mussel Farm, and who could not talk, could only discourse, expound, explain. Shadow had figured out within the first few minutes of meeting Mr. Ibis that his expected part in any conversation with the funeral director was to say as little as possible. This, I believe, is because people like to know what they are getting ahead of time, thus McDonald's, Walmart, F.W. Woolworth of blessed memory. Store brands maintained and visible across the entire country. Wherever you go, you will get something that is, with small regional variations, the same. In the field of funeral homes, however, things are perforce different. You need to feel that you are getting small-town personal service from someone who has a calling to the profession. You want personal attention to you and your loved one in a time of great loss. You wish to know that your grief is happening on a local level, not on a national one. But in all branches of industry, and death is an industry, my young friend, make no mistake about that, one makes one's money from operating in bulk, from buying in quantity, from centralizing one's operations. It's not pretty, but it's true. Trouble is, no one wants to know that their loved ones are traveling in a cooler van to some big old converted warehouse where they may have 20, 50, 100 cadavers on the go. No, sir, folks want to think they're going to a family concern, somewhere they'll be treated with respect by someone who'll tip his hat to them if he sees them in the street. Mr. Ibis wore a hat. It was a sober brown hat that matched his sober brown blazer and his sober brown face. Small gold-rimmed glasses perched on his nose. In Shadow's memory, Mr. Ibis was a short man. Whenever he would stand beside him, Shadow would rediscover that Mr. Ibis was well over 6 feet in height, with a crane-like stoop. Sitting opposite him now, across the shiny red table, Shadow found himself staring into the man's face. "So when the big companies come in, they buy the name of the company, they pay the funeral directors to stay on, they create the apparency of diversity. But that is merely the tip of the gravestone. In reality, they are as local as Burger King. Now, for our own reasons, we are truly and independent. We do all our own embalming, and it's the finest embalming in the country, although nobody knows it but us. We don't do cremations, though. We could make more money if we had our own crematorium, but it goes against what we're good at. What my business partner says is, if the Lord gives you a talent or a skill, you have an obligation to use it as best you can. Don't you agree?"
"Sounds good to me," said Shadow.
"The Lord gave my business partner dominion over the dead, just as he gave me skill with words. Fine things, words. I write books of tales, you know. Nothing literary, just for my own amusement. Accounts of lives."
He paused. By the time Shadow realized that he should have asked if he might be allowed to read one, the moment had passed.
"Anyway, what we give them here is continuity. There's been an Ibis and Jacquel in business here for almost 200 years. We weren't always funeral directors, though. We used to be morticians, and before that, undertakers."
"And before that?"
"Well," said Mr. Ibis, smiling just a little smugly, "we go back a very long way. Of course, it wasn't until after the war between the states that we found our niche here. That was when we became the funeral parlor for the colored folks hereabouts. Before that, no one thought of us as colored. Foreign, maybe. Exotic and dark, but not colored. Once the war was done, pretty soon, no one could remember a time when we weren't perceived as black. My business partner, he's always had darker skin than mine. It was an easy transition. Mostly, you are what they think you are. It's just strange when they talk about African-Americans. Makes me think of the people from Punt, Ophir, Nubia. We never thought of ourselves as Africans. We were the people of the Nile.
So you were Egyptians, said Shadow.
Mr. Ibis pushed his lower lip upward, then let his head bob from side to side as if it were on a spring, weighing the pluses and minuses, seeing things from both points of view. Well, yes and no. Egyptians makes me think of the folk who live there now, the ones who built their cities over our graveyards and palaces. Do they look like me?
Shadow shrugged. He'd seen black guys who looked like Mr. Ibis. He'd seen white guys with tans who looked like Mr. Ibis.
How's your coffee cake? Asked the waitress, refilling their coffees. Best I ever had, said Mr. Ibis. You give my best to your ma. I'll do that, she said, and bustled away. You don't want to ask after the health of anyone if you're a funeral director. They think maybe you're scouting for business, said Mr. Ibis in an undertone. Shall we see if your room is ready?
Their breath steamed in the night air. Christmas lights twinkled in the windows of the stores they passed.
It's good of you putting me up, said Shadow. I appreciate it.
We owe your employer a number of favors. And Lord knows we have the room. It's a big old house. There used to be more of us, you know. Now it's just the three of us. You won't be in the way.
Any idea how long I'm meant to stay with you?
Mr. Ibis shook his head. He didn't say, but we are happy to have you here, and we can find you work if you are not squeamish. If you treat the dead with respect.
So, asked Shadow, what are you people doing here in Cairo? Was it just the name or something?
No, not at all. Actually, this region takes its names from us, although people barely know it. It was a trading post back in the old days.
Frontier times?
You might call it that, said Mr. Ibis. Evening, Miss Simmons, and a Merry Christmas to you, too.
The folk who brought me here came up the Mississippi a long time back. Shadow stopped in the street and stared. Are you trying to tell me that ancient Egyptians came here to trade 5,000 years ago? Mr. Ibis said nothing, but he smirked loudly. Then he said,
3,530 years ago. Give or take.
Okay, said Shadow. I'll buy it, I guess. What were they trading?
Not much, said Mr. Ibis. Animal skins, some food, copper from the mines in what would now be Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The whole thing was rather a disappointment, not worth the effort. They stayed here long enough to believe in us, to sacrifice to us, and for a handful of the traders to die of fever and be buried here, leaving us behind them.
He stopped dead in the middle of the sidewalk, turned around slowly, arms extended.
This country has been Grand Central for 10,000 years or more. You say to me, what about Columbus?
Sure, said Shadow, obligingly. What about him?
Columbus did what people had been doing for thousands of years. There's nothing special about coming to America. I've been writing stories about it from time to time.
They began to walk again.
True stories?
Up to a point, yes. I'll let you read one or two if you like. It's all there for anyone who has eyes to see it. Personally, and this is speaking as a subscriber to Scientific American, here, I feel very sorry for the professionals whenever they find another confusing skull, something that belonged to the wrong sort of people, or whenever they find statues or artifacts that confuse them. For they'll talk about the odd, but they won't talk about the impossible, which is where I feel sorry for them. For as soon as something becomes impossible, it slipslides out of belief entirely, whether it's true or not. I mean, here's a skull that shows the Ainu, the Japanese aboriginal race, were in America 9,000 years ago. Here's another that shows there were Polynesians in California nearly 2,000 years later. And all the scientists mutter and puzzle over who's descended from whom, missing the point entirely. Heaven knows what'll happen if they ever actually find the Hopi emergence tunnels. That'll shake a few things up, you just wait. Did the Irish come to America in the Dark Ages, you ask me? Of course they did. And the Welsh, and the Vikings, while the Africans from the West Coast, what in later days they called the Slave Coast or the Ivory Coast, they were trading with South America, and the Chinese visited Oregon a couple of times. They called it Fusang. The Basque established their secret sacred fishing grounds off the coast of Newfoundland 1,200 years back. Now, I suppose you're going to say, but Mr. Ibis, these people were primitives. They didn't have radio controls and vitamin pills and jet airplanes. Shadow hadn't said anything, and hadn't planned to say anything, but he felt it was required of him, so he said, "Well, weren't they?" The last dead leaves of the autumn crackled underfoot. Winter crisp. The misconception is that men didn't travel long distances in boats before the days of Columbus, yet New Zealand and Tahiti and countless Pacific islands were settled by people in boats whose navigation skills would have put Columbus to shame. And the wealth of Africa was from trading, although that was mostly to the east, to India and China. My people, the Nile folk, we discovered early on that a reed boat will take you around the world if you have the patience and enough jars of sweet water. You see, the biggest problem with coming to America in the old days was that there wasn't a lot here that anyone wanted to trade, and it was much too far away. They had reached a large house, built in the style people called Queen Anne. Shadow wondered who Queen Anne was and why she had been so fond of Adams family-style houses. It was the only building on the block that wasn't locked up with boarded-over windows. They went through the gate and walked around the back of the building. Through large double doors, which Mr. Ibis unlocked with a key from his keychain, and they were in a large, unheated room occupied by two people. They were a very tall, dark-skinned man, holding a large metal scalpel, and a dead girl in her late teens, lying on a long porcelain table that resembled both a slab and a sink. There were several photographs of the dead girl pinned up on a cork board on the wall above the body. She was smiling in one, a high school headshot. In another she was standing in a line with three other girls. They were wearing what might have been prom dresses, and her black hair was tied above her head in an intricate knotwork. Cold on the porcelain, her hair was down, loose around her shoulders, and matted with dried blood. "This is my partner, Mr. Jacquel," said Ibis.
"We met already," said Jacquel. "Forgive me if I don't shake hands."
Shadow looked down at the girl on the table.
"What happened to her?" he asked. "Poor taste in boyfriends," said Jacquel.
"It's not always fatal," said Mr. Ibis with a sigh. "This time it was. He was drunk, and they had a knife, and she told him that she thought she was pregnant. He didn't believe it was his."
"She was stabbed," said Mr. Jacquel, and he counted.
There was a click as he stepped on a foot switch, turning on a small dictaphone on a nearby table.
5 times. There are 3 knife wounds in the left anterior chest wall. The first is between the 4th and 5th intercostal spaces at the medial border of the left breast, 2.2 centimeters in length. The second and third are through the inferior portion of the left mid-breast, penetrating at the sixth interspace, overlapping and measuring 3 centimeters. There is one wound 2 centimeters long in the upper anterior left chest in the second interspace, and one wound 5 centimeters long and a maximum of 1.6 centimeters deep in the anteromedial left deltoid, a slashing injury. All the chest wounds are deep penetrating injuries. There are no other visible wounds externally. He released pressure from the foot switch. Shadow noticed a small microphone dangling above the embalming table by its cord.
"So you're the coroner as well?" asked Shadow.
"Coroner's a political appointment around here," said Ibis. "His job is to kick the corpse. If it doesn't kick him back, he signs the death certificate. Jacquel's what they call a prosector. He works for the county medical examiner. He does autopsies and saves tissue samples for analysis. He's already photographed her wounds."
Jacquel ignored them.
He took a big scalpel and made a deep incision in a large V, which began at both collarbones and met at the bottom of her breastbone, and then he turned the V into a Y, another deep incision that continued from her breastbone to her pubis. He picked up what looked like a small, heavy chrome drill with a medallion-sized, round saw blade at the business end. He turned it on and cut through the ribs at both sides of her breastbone. The girl opened like a purse. Shadow suddenly was aware of a mild but unpleasantly penetrating, pungent, meaty smell.
"I thought it would smell worse," said Shadow.
"She's pretty fresh," said Jacquel, "and the intestines weren't pierced, so it doesn't smell of shit."
Shadow found himself looking away, not from revulsion, as he would have expected, but from a strange desire to give the girl some privacy. It would be hard to be nakeder than this open thing. Jacquel tied off the intestines, glistening and snake-like in her belly, below the stomach and deep in the pelvis. He ran them through his fingers, foot after foot of them, described them as normal to the microphone, put them in a bucket on the floor. He sucked all the blood out of her chest with a vacuum pump and measured the volume. Then he inspected the inside of her chest. He said to the microphone, "There are 3 lacerations in the pericardium, which is filled with clotted and liquefying blood." Jacquel grasped her heart, cut it at its top, turned it about in his hand, examining it. He stepped on his switch and said, "There are 2 lacerations of the myocardium, a 1.5 centimeter laceration in the right ventricle and a 1.8 centimeter laceration penetrating the left ventricle." Jacquel removed each lung. The left lung had been stabbed and was half collapsed. He weighed them and the heart, and he photographed the wounds. From each lung he sliced a small piece of tissue, which he placed into a jar.
"Formaldehyde," whispered Mr. Ibis helpfully.
Jacquel continued to talk to the microphone, describing what he was doing, what he saw, as he removed the girl's liver, the stomach, spleen, pancreas, both kidneys, the uterus, and the ovaries. He weighed each organ, reported them as normal and uninjured. From each organ he took a small slice and put it into a jar of formaldehyde. From the heart, the liver, and from one of the kidneys, he cut an additional slice. These pieces he chewed slowly, making it last while he worked. Somehow it seemed to Shadow a good thing for him to do. Respectful, not obscene.
"So you want to stay here with us for a spell?" said Jacquel, masticating the slice of the girl's heart.
"If you'll have me," said Shadow.
"Certainly we'll have you," said Mr. Ibis. "No reasons why not, and plenty of reasons why. You'll be under our protection as long as you're here."
"I hope you don't mind sleeping under the same roof as the dead," said Jacquel.
Shadow thought of the touch of Laura's lips, bitter and cold. "No," he said. "Not as long as they stay dead, anyhow." Jacquel turned and looked at him with dark brown eyes as quizzical and cold as a desert dog's.
"They stay dead here," was all he said.
"Seems to me," said Shadow, "seems to me that the dead come back pretty easy."
"Not at all," said Ibis. "Even zombies, they make them out of the living, you know. A little powder, a little chanting, a little push, and you have a zombie. They live, but they believe they are dead. But to truly bring the dead back to life, in their bodies, that takes power."
He hesitates, then.
"In the old land, in the old days, it was easier then."
"You could bind the ka of a man to his body for 5,000 years, said Jacquel. "Binding or loosing, but that was a long time ago."
He took all the organs that he had removed and replaced them respectfully in the body cavity. He replaced the intestines and the breastbone and pulled the skin edges near each other. Then he took a thick needle and thread and, with deft, quick strokes, he sewed it up, like a man stitching a baseball. The cadaver transformed from meat into girl once again.
"I need a beer," said Jacquel.
He pulled off his rubber gloves and dropped them into the bin. He dropped his dark brown overalls into a hamper. Then he took the cardboard tray of jars filled with little red and brown and purple slices of the organs.
"Coming?"
They walked up the back stairs to the kitchen. It was brown and white, a sober and respectable room that looked to Shadow as if it had last been decorated in 1920. There was a huge Kelvinator rattling to itself by one wall. Jacquel opened the Kelvinator door, put the plastic jars with their slivers of spleen, of kidney, of liver, of heart, inside. He took out 3 brown bottles. Ibis opened a glass-fronted cupboard, removed 3 tall glasses. Then he gestured for Shadow to sit down at the kitchen table. Ibis poured the beer and passed a glass to Shadow, a glass to Jacquel. It was a fine beer, bitter and dark.
"Good beer," said Shadow.
"We brew it ourselves," said Ibis.
"In the old days the women did the brewing. They were better brewers than we are, but now it's only the 3 of us here, me, him, and her."
He gestured toward the small brown cat, fast asleep in a cat basket in the corner of the room.
"There were more of us in the beginning, but Set left us to explore, what, 200 years ago? Must be by now. We got a postcard from him from San Francisco in 1905, 1906, then nothing. While poor Horace..."
He trailed off in a sigh and shook his head.
"I still see him on occasion," said Jacquel, "on my way to a pickup."
He sipped his beer.
"I'll work for my keep," said Shadow, "while I'm here. You tell me what you need doing, and I'll do it."
"We'll find work for you," agreed Jacquel. The small brown cat opened her eyes and stretched to her feet. She padded across the kitchen floor and pushed at Shadow's boot with her head. He put down his left hand and scratched her forehead and the back of her ears and the scruff of her neck. She arched ecstatically, then sprang into his lap, pushed herself up against his chest, and touched her cold nose to his. Then she curled up in his lap and went back to sleep. He put his hand down to stroke her. Her fur was soft, and she was warm and pleasant in his lap. She acted like she was in the safest place in the world, and Shadow felt comforted. The beer left a pleasant buzz in Shadow's head.
"Your room is at the top of the stairs by the bathroom," said Jacquel. "Your work clothes will be hanging in the closet, you'll see. You'll want to wash up and shave first, I guess."
Shadow did. He showered standing in the cast-iron tub, and he shaved, very nervously, with a straight razor that Jacquel loaned him. It was obscenely sharp, and had a mother-of-pearl handle, and Shadow suspected it was usually used to give dead men their final shave. He had never used a straight razor before, but he did not cut himself. He washed off the shaving cream, looked at himself naked in the fly-specked bathroom mirror. He was bruised,
fresh bruises on his chest and arms overlaying the fading bruises that Mad Sweeney had left him. His eyes looked back mistrustfully from the mirror at him. And then, as if someone else were holding his hand, he raised the straight razor, placed it blade open,